Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
Wow, I don't think I've ever cut it that close before in my life. Oh, I didn't even know they'd be playing the music there. I was getting nervous. No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 10. The final season, the final journey into the unknown with Banal of America in the seasonal format. Don't freak out, folks. And as I mentioned on last week's show, we're going through a little wave, a flap, if you will, of first-time guests, long-overdue guests, people I should have had on over the years, but they fell through the cracks, and I wanted to make sure I remedied that. And I had the list of these folks. I've kind of parsed it down over time because it's like, oh, Jesus, a lot of people I wish I had interviewed. But there were like a handful left that I really wanted to get to here for Season 10. And as the fates would allow it, it turned out tonight's guest was on the list, and we ran into each other over the weekend in Portland, Maine. So it was in the ether. It was like fated to be. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome to the program Robert Schneck. He is he's an author. He's a collector of strange and unusual stories from America's past. He's wildly popular, and people have been recommending I get him on the show for years. And I've always like, I'm just a lazy producer. I'm not a great host either, but I'm a lazy producer too. So it never happened. But we got him on the show tonight. Now he's the author of The President's Vampire, Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist, and The Bye-Bye Man, and other strange but true tales. And if the title of that last book sounds familiar, folks, that's because they actually made a movie about the Bye-Bye Man story. We're going to try and pick his brain a little bit about that process when we get talking. But welcome to the show, Robert Schneck. Thank you so much for coming on the show and doing it on a really short notice, because I sprung this on you, I think, Monday morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Tim. I'm happy to be here, and yes, it is way, way overdue.
Yes, yes, but we're going to make up for it here on the program tonight. Now, generally, we start with the bio and background, but I got to mention this weekend's event, because a lot of people know that I was there, and you were there, and I just got to say kudos to Lauren Coleman and the folks at the International Cryptozoology Museum. This was just an absolutely outstanding, unforgettable day and weekend, really, of just, it was like a sensory overload. It was like cool thoughts overload. It was cool things. It was just really amazing. And top to bottom, having been to a number of these things, folks, this show had to be easily, you know, one of the most professionally and classiest and well-produced and just down to the tiniest detail, you know, nothing went unnoticed with this conference. They really, really, really put their heart and soul into this, and they raised the bar, I think, for paranormal conferences, because anytime I go to the next one, I'm going to get the itinerary on a sheet of paper, and I'm going to be like, Lauren's Museum had it on glossy cardstock. So that's how right, Robert?
Oh, well, yeah, I actually, this was only the second one I've ever been to. And I know that the thing that really impressed me. And, you know, everything you said is right. But one of the things that really got my attention was how many young people were there.
Yes, yes.
Because from what I understand, a lot of these conferences, the cane, crutch, and wheelchair brigade is pretty well represented.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The blue hairs.
The blue hairs, yeah. And my hair is getting blue, so I can say that. but this conference, there were young people. There were young people speaking. There was a panel of young people. And there were young people attending, which, you know, I realize that this is probably has a lot to do with the popularity of things like Hunting Bigfoot on television and, you know, reality programming. I don't care. Whatever gets them in there.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I wonder how many people of my generation got interested in it because of Leonard Nimoy on In Search Of.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, definitely. I was influenced by Unsolved Mysteries. So it's like, I can't begrudge some kid that likes it because he likes Bigfoot hunters or whatever it's called.
Right, yeah. So, you know, even though I hate the word squatching, I really do hate that word. But
I do too, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's just an ugly word. But having said that, you know, whatever works, and like I said, it was just so great to see them. And yes, everything went off so smoothly. It was even the technology, everything worked.
Yeah, it was great. And I'm glad you mentioned that because that was one of the things that stood out to me. The young people. I've never been to a paranormal conference that had a youth panel.
Right.
Like that was, and you know something, I'll admit it. Like going into it, I was like, that sounds kind of silly or something. But afterwards, I was like, that was awesome. That was so uplifting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really the feeling I got.
I think it also points to the intelligence that Lauren puts into this stuff. Mm. You know, he really is into cryptozoology for the long haul. I mean, you go to his museum, and one of the first things he'll tell you is that he has it set up to keep going after he's dead.
Yeah, you know? There's a macabre element to it, but it's like only I can. That's so Lauren. Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's one of the reasons why he is just so valuable to anyone who's interested in paranormal. And again, for me personally, he's just been a major influence on on some of the things I've written and some of the things I've thought about. To tell you the truth, I mean, the paranormal has been part of my life since the beginning. Not that I saw ghosts or anything when I was a kid. I picked up a copy of Frank Edwards' Stranger Than Science. My mother had left it on her night table. I think I was 9, maybe. And the cover was, I remember this very vividly, the cover was held on with a piece of electrical tape. That's how many times it had been read and passed around.
Oh, wow.
Well, I read that book, and that did it. That was what I was going to do. I got away from it for a long time, but then I picked up a copy of Mysterious America, and that just pulled me back in. So, but on top of that, and Lauren's interest in suicide, which has also gotten me interested in suicide, and his interest in words, names, and dates, and things like that. It just, like I said, it did a lot to pull me back into this.
Yeah, that's another thing I really appreciate about Lauren is that he covers all the different sort of, like, it's hard to explain to some people who don't know this, but it's like he has that whole side sort of area of, like, they kind of cross streams at the Killer Clowns, but then it's like, and he also looks at, like, mass murders and mass shootings and copycat effect and synchronistic language and things like that where it's like, this is the Bigfoot guy? It's like, yes, it is. He's amazing.
and again, it's one of those things a lot of people don't know. But they should, if they're interested in the things he does, they should take a look at that because it is fascinating in its own right.
Absolutely. So that's our part about putting over Lauren's conference. It was amazing, folks. And I tried to tell you guys when he was on in May, I told you to go. So
The thing was sold out.
Oh, I know. Yeah. It was sold out, and it's funny. The combination, yeah, two strands from that, what we're talking about. Like, I was laughing about it, but as I was walking in from having a cigarette, there were these two, there were these two young people who were way cooler than me. They were, some people would call them hipsters, but I'll respect. They were just plain cooler than me. I don't know if that makes me an unhipster or not. But and as I got, you know, the sign had a big sold out on it, and they're behind me walking in. She's got like tights that like have tears in them and stuff. That's why, you know, it's like, oh geez, these people they wouldn't like me. So we get to the thing. And I hear, like, the dude behind me, he's with her, and he's like, oh, man, sold out. And I was like, wow, they're here for the Bigfoot thing? This is awesome.
Yeah, it really is. And like I said, it makes me happy for the future.
Absolutely. So,
especially when you compare it to something like ufology,
which
is just going crazy. It's entered the period of senile dementia.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to hold back on this part of my observation. We didn't get a chance to talk. First, folks, you wouldn't believe it, but I'm, like, incredibly shy at these things. I don't like to really – I'm a terrible networker. So it wasn't until, like, the very end that I put two and two together and realized Robert was the same Robert Schneck, even though – no, some other – so it wasn't until, like, the very end on the last day, last morning, where I'm like, oh – So that's why. And the other part is, unlike like every paranormal conference I've been to in so long, from the moment I sat down at 8 in the morning, I like really wanted to see these presentations. And it's like, usually I'm really jaded about it, but I was like, they were just really interesting and interesting sort of takes on things. So Robert and I, we didn't cross paths until the last day. But before I went up to Portland, I went to the Exeter UFO Festival, a wonderful event, great people, fantastic speakers, but a completely different vibe. Like it just felt like kitschy and retro. That was the vibe from like the festival feel and the town and just the whole like UFO mythos. The whole aliens everywhere, and it was just like kitschy and retro. It was like night and day with the crypto conference.
And you know, people are arguing about things that no one's cared about in 20 years. You know, everyone's suing each other.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone hates each other. There are these little cultish groups, you know, these little cliques that follow this ufologist and this ufologist. And it's just... it's not a healthy place to be. Not yet, anyway. You know, these things have a way of coming around, and something will happen that'll bring it back to life.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure.
It'll mutate. It'll mutate into something else. You know, it was like ufology started out with nuts and bolts, flying saucers. Well, no, actually, it didn't. It started out with a lot of spiritualism and mysticism. Then it became about nuts and bolts, flying saucers, and then it all became about abduction.
Yeah.
And that was actually where I mean, my introduction to ufology was attending an intruders conference.
Oh, wow.
The intruders organization that Bud Hopkins and... is it Stan Jacobs?
David Jacobs.
David Jacobs, yeah. They were both there, and there were people, there were about 300 people in the Edgar Cayce Foundation in New York City, and I think I was the only one there that never claims to have been abducted. And it was about 3 hours long, and when I left, I felt like my brain had been taken out, put into a blender, and poured back in.
Oh, wow.
It was a bizarre experience, but I'm still glad I went because I had a chance to meet Bud Hopkins and, you know, but there was a pervasive sense of unreality to the whole thing.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And
as opposed to this where at least, you know, hey, it's either out there or it isn't.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the whole UFO thing is just so complex now and exhausting. And it's funny, you literally, like, described what happened, in a sense, at the event. And I'll just tell the story, I guess. This is not a slam on anyone, folks. I feel bad even doing it. But a guy in the meet and greet asked a question of Rich Dolan about a story from a book that came out in the year 2000. oh God, involving Wernher von Braun saying that like they were going to do false flag attacks and stuff like that. You know, first it was going to be communists, and then terrorists, and then aliens, and then asteroids, or something like that. And he told this to his assistant, and it got leaked, and, you know, got into the UFO press, and finally got into a book in the year 2000. And it was like, do you know anything more about it? Essentially was, like, the question. And it's like, dude, the book came out, like, 17 years ago. Like, no, you know, no one knows anything more about it. It's just what the lady says he told her.
Right. It's like Roswell and things like the fact that people are still finding new angles on Roswell is astonishing to me. But, you know, Nick Redfern just put a book out a few years ago that has a whole different take on it. So,
yeah.
You know, I generally stay out of ufology, though. I avoid ufology. I avoid the Kennedy assassination and one or two other things because you just get down the rabbit hole a little too fast and a little too deep for my taste.
Yeah, it's like quicksand.
Yeah.
It's like quicksand, yeah, yeah. So that was, the Lawrence, the International Cryptozoology Museum's conference. And folks, go to their website, find out more. They're going to do it again next year. It was really awesome. It was really, really awesome. And hats off to Lauren and company and all the folks over there. Jeff Muse, too. He's the unsung hero over there. He does so much work. I was telling him, everyone wants to come hug Lauren. It's like, someone give Jeff a hug. Would you, geez? the guy's doing all kinds of stuff.
It's almost enough to make you forgive Lauren for starting it at 7 a.m.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, so check that out, folks, because it was really awesome. Now, you kind of teased a little bit about the bio background, talking about some of the early influences, but I guess talk about what, you know, led you, because I was kind of talking about this in a sense over the weekend with some folks. It's like some people are happy to be entertained and interested in this stuff, and other people feel compelled to produce stuff like I do and you do. So
mm-hmm.
How, you know, what led you to becoming, you know, an author about this stuff, a collector of these stories and a teller of these stories?
Well, again, it started with Frank Edwards and Stranger Than Science, which I still love that book because it casts such a wide net. You can he 30 or 40 itsy bitsy little chapters, maybe they're two or three pages each, and a lot of them are really just paraphrased they're paraphrased clippings from Fate magazine. But that was how I was introduced to it, and I loved it. You know, it just made the world seem so incredibly exotic and full of magic, if you like, if you don't mind that using that word for it. From there, I went to my libraries had two books. They had On the Track of Unknown Animals by Bernard Heuvelman, and they had Abominable Snowmen, Legend Comes to Life by Ivan Sanderson. Those were the first two big books I ever read. And they left a mark, to say the least. Ivan Sanderson is, if I ever had a childhood hero, it would probably be Ivan Sanderson, just because he just did so many things, and they were so exciting. And you know, he wrote about walking around the jungle wearing pajamas and seeing these incredible animals. It was just, again, it was exciting to me. And as it turned out, he actually had an office very close to where I grew up. I didn't know it at the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I wish I did. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I always stuck with whatever was strange, whatever was odd, and whatever made them uncomfortable, I generally gravitated towards. So I was reading about serial killers before serial killers were cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I was always interested in visiting any place that might be haunted, that might have a history of something horrible that happened there. Just being on the spot fascinated me. And so, of course, monsters went along right with it. So did witchcraft, and the flying saucers, always to a lesser extent. My brother loves sci-fi, and that kind of he had more of an interest in it than me, though he always stuck with sci-fi, and the saucer thing never really became a part of his life.
But, right.
And again, for me, it was just The only stories I really liked were the ones that were so bizarre they didn't make any sense at all. Like,
right, right. Yeah.
Those just, you know, when I read those, they just, my jaw just hangs open that these stories are so strange.
Mm.
But at the same time, I was also very interested in folklore and history, regular mainline history. So everything kind of came together when I was in my mid-30s, because my education is actually in illustration of all things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I mean, I have a degree in illustration. I worked as an illustrator for years, so I was illustrating magazine articles and things like that, and I got tired of illustration. I didn't care for the business, although I did enjoy illustrating, but the business didn't agree with me, and it was all changing to computers. And I realized I needed a job where I didn't have to deal with anybody at all. So I decided, you know, writing worked because I didn't have to leave the house. And there were plenty of things that genuinely fascinated me. And, again, anything that was anomalous and didn't fit, that was just where I headed. And so I began writing. It actually, the first piece I ever wrote was from a serial killer book, strangely enough. It was from a book that was a collection of writings by serial killers. I just remember the publisher, because the publisher was Bloat, which I just thought was a cool name for a press.
Yeah, yeah.
Bloat Press. And they had a section on a notebook that was written by Charles Starkweather, the Nebraska spree killer back in the 50s, who became like the quintessential juvenile delinquent that adults were scared of in the 1950s. Mm. Anyway, when he was a young man, he said that the figure of death used to appear outside of his window and scream when he was a young man growing up in Lincoln, Nebraska. And he even included a drawing of it, and he drew this, it's just sort of a bulky shape that comes to a point on top. And as I'm reading this, I'm saying, it screamed, it appeared outside his window, and it had a bulky shape with a point on top. That sounds like a Bigfoot.
Oh, wow.
And I have no proof. It's only what Charles Starkweather wrote. But at that time, Fate magazine was going through a change. It had become a large size magazine.
Oh, I remember that area.
Yeah. So they were trying for a hipper, more 40s times kind of style.
Yeah.
And they were publishing stories that were a little edgier. They ended up losing a lot of subscribers because of that. And I remember particularly they ran a story on a penis temple in Thailand, I think.
Wow,
and
that
offended a lot of their older readers. Anyway, I wrote this article on Starkweather's Bigfoot sightings, or maybe possible Bigfoot sightings, and I was very, very insecure about my writing, so I made sure to include an illustration of it. Of the story.
Oh, that's clever. Yes.
Yeah, I was really insecure about my writing at the time. I still am, which is why it takes me so long to write anything. But they liked it. They printed it, and well, that did it. Oh, and then what happens? I get an email from Lauren Coleman. Asking if he can use it in one of his books. Well, that more or less sealed my fate. So from there I began, most of my writing tends to involve an element of horrific violence, insanity, and the paranormal. That's the trifecta for me.
Yeah.
So I was drawn to stories that involved at least some of those elements, and I began to write the socially redeeming material for some adult magazines.
Ah, okay, the articles that people say they read, yeah.
Right, right.
This is not a joke, folks. Those are usually great articles.
I was writing for Swank, and I was doing a monthly story for them on something paranormal. And they were great, and having to turn out a paranormal story every month was great practice. And so I was starting to put stuff together, and then I discovered the Fortean Times, and that more or less has been my home ever since. And at some point, I decided to say, well, I really want to write a book, because you just having a book is so much more prestigious. You're taken so much more seriously if you have a book. And the fact is that even though I was writing straight stories for adult magazines, I couldn't easily put the clippings I couldn't approach a publisher saying, well, this was in Swank, this was in High Society, this was in Screw, and this was in Hustler.
Yeah. It's like special thanks to, in the end of the book, special thanks to High Society, Screw,
right,
and Hustler for their help in producing
exactly.
this book.
Exactly. Actually, I wish I could have been in Hustler. It's very hard to get work in them because they had really high standards, and they weren't interested in the paranormal.
Yeah. But, again, people laugh, but when you've seen the same... It's the same lady, same three pictures of the naked lady, and you're like, 15. Eventually, you read the articles, and they're really good. They're really, really good stuff. I'm not even joking. I remember many times being like, wow, that was a powerful piece I just read.
Uh huh. Well, I think part of that is there was a certain feeling of, look, we've got, they're going to buy it for the naked lady. But so we just need to put in something to take up the spaces between the advertisements, and that gave you a lot of leeway.
Yeah, and it's like they don't have to worry about advertisers like
no,
dropping.
No.
Look at. Okay, the pictorial was fine, as wild as it was, but the article on UFOs or whatever, I can't. The dildo company can't abide by that.
We're a family company, damn it.
Yeah. We're getting a lot of heat from the boys upstairs about that dildo ad you guys had.
But, man. So, again, it was really a great way to get in print
and
get over that initial fear of I will never have anything published in a regular magazine. At one point, I was writing for Swank and Boys Life at the same time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's not that unusual. For Boys Life, I wrote one of my first it wasn't even a paranormal article. Again, I only write so much on the paranormal. A lot of what I write about
is like true crimey type stuff.
It's not even quite that. It's very, very eccentric and bizarre behavior.
That's a good, yeah. There's really no way, there's no like...
That's not a genre.
Right.
So that's why if somebody asks me what I write, I just say strange but true.
Yeah. No, that fits. Yeah. Well, you've covered out quite a niche on these stories because
I think my publisher is my publisher is actually my next book is going to be on haunted houses, which sounds kind of stale. I know, but this is going to be a very different take on them, and I think from his perspective. He likes the idea. This will make it much easier for him to market because I'm a little difficult to market because it's not exactly paranormal. It's not exactly history. And then, you know, when one of my books has a title like Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist, there's always the danger it'll end up in the religious section.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh, man, that's true. You've carved out a pretty cool niche here of covering stories that I haven't seen done anywhere else. You know what I mean?
That was always my, as I'm really just a fan turned writer. That's all. And I got tired. I don't like reading the same story year after year after year. And there is an endless amount of recycling. In the strange and paranormal. So when I set out to write a story, I had a few standards. My standards are not wildly high, but I had a few of them. It had to be a story that I haven't read everywhere, or if it was a story that I read everywhere, I had to have a very different take on it or some really interesting new information. And if I had those things, I would go ahead and write it. Now, that can be difficult because part of the reason why some stories haven't been written is there just isn't much available.
Right, right, exactly that. They pop up as like maybe one newspaper article, and half the time you can't really track down the people because it's like from 70 years ago or something.
Well, fortunately, I was fortunate also in that I started writing at a time when suddenly newspaper databases and ancestry, genealogical material, all that stuff was suddenly available.
Right, and just the internet in general, you can kind of like, because someone else like in Tuscaloosa maybe like, I'm trying to find out more about this Mad Hatter or Maskatoon, and it turns out here's all my shit.
Right.
Where did you get? How did you find this?
Well, I mean, there is a chapter on. One of the things that I have found is that writers, who at least I can't talk for writers in general, but writers who are interested in the things that we're talking about, they can be incredibly generous with material. There is one writer named Joe Derwin who wrote a piece on – he did a lot of research on clowns. This was before clowns became a fad.
Yeah.
And when I asked him some questions, because I told him I would like to write a piece about clowns sometime, he just handed me his information. He mailed me a disc that contained more information on clowns than – I have ever seen anywhere, and he just gave it to me. So, and I've tried to be that way with other people because you do get some people who hide their information, and, they put it away, they hoard it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I can kind of understand that. I hoard when I'm going to write about something, when I know I'm going to write about it.
Right, right. If you come up with, like, a particularly good idea, you kind of like, everyone does that. Yeah, yeah.
Sure. But, he made it possible for me to write what I believe is the only attempt to explain the origins of the clown panics of the 1980s and the possible origin of the clown panics today. But again, it was really his generosity that made it possible. I had some ideas, but he gave me the material.
Yeah.
So again, it's just the writers that I have met have all been terrific. In fact, one of the people when I found that Linda Godfrey was going to be at this conference, that was one of the reasons I went, because I just wanted to meet her. I mean, we've known each other online for years.
It was great meeting her. Yeah, she was a gem. She was a gem.
She really is. And it's so funny because she writes about werewolves and dogmen, and she's this little sparrow of a woman, you know?
Thank you. Yes, that's exactly what I noticed. And not only that she's just a little lady, and she's out there. Like, she was telling me this story about how her and her friends were out where there were some dogmen sightings. This is, like, in recent years, not like when they were teenagers. And they were looking around at stuff, and a crab apple came up flying through the air, like, from down below, like a hill. So there's no way it would have, like, it shouldn't have done that. But
it was an unnatural crab apple.
Exactly, yeah. And it bounced along, in front of them. And then she, like, showed me a video of them talking about it afterwards. And it was, like, two of her friends, and it looked like a bridge club, And it was like, oh, my God, what are you doing out in the woods, Linda? Like, you're braver. You're far braver than I am. Like, I wouldn't be venturing out into dogman country. And she's out there, like, with her posse. And I was like, what? This lady's amazing. Yeah, yeah, she's wonderful.
And, part of the reason why I loved her work from the very first time I found it, and I know this sounds a lot like a mutual admiration club, but I'm sorry, I really do admire some of these people. And When I first read her book, one of the things that struck me about it was it took me back to the books that I read growing up, in that it was a book about monsters I had never heard of, people that were actually looking for them, and stories that had just happened.
Mm.
So, again, this was living. This wasn't fossilized like so many of the stories were. She knows these people.
Right, right.
And this just happened. She can take you to the place where it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that just, that even though I don't do that because I kind of lack people skills, I admire her ability to do it, and that's why I enjoy her work so much.
Yeah. You sound like me. You're shy, probably, you know? It's like,
I am shy, but more than that, I have a genius for saying the wrong thing. I mean,
oh, no.
It's practically a psychic power. I will, if I make a joke about a blue hippopotamus, there will be someone in the room whose father was killed by a blue hippopotamus.
Yeah, yeah.
and will run out of the room crying.
Yeah.
Again, I've always been able to do this. I don't know where it comes from.
It's like a psychic gift. You have the worst X-Man power.
Exactly. and so most of my work consists of documents.
Mm.
You know, I work from historical documents, things that sound really dull. I mean, censuses, plat maps and things like that, but it brings history just to it makes everything real.
Yeah.
And I love it. So, you know, again, that's why I can't do contemporary stuff too well.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I mean, just being able to, you know,
both ends are a waiting game, but in the contemporary thing, it's like you're just kind of waiting for things to unfold as it is.
Well, you know, with someone like Linda, people are coming to her with stuff, and she really can, she can pick and choose what she chooses to write about, but at the same time, she has to develop boundaries and learn to deal with people who can be very needy, or let's just say it, some of them can be mentally ill.
I was just going to say, she's also dealing with a possible, she could be dealing, I mean, there are people I know in this field who have, like, worked with people for years, and then it turns out they made a lot of stuff up, and it's
right.
Like, wait a minute, yeah, so.
Oh, yeah, or even if they didn't make it up, it was a fantasy for them. It was, all right, maybe they made it up, but it's not a lie or a hoax in the ordinary sense. It can be very real and important to them. But, you know, you've written about it, you got your name on it, and it never happened.
Right, right. And the troubling part is, exactly. And it's not like you're looking at an old story from someone who told a story. It's like, this is from your friend Billy.
Right,
like, who
exactly.
You've spent the last, you know, 3 years talking to on the phone, and next thing you know, it's like, Billy, you mean you weren't in the Army?
Yeah, you get stuff like that. You see, with me, if a story happens like that, I look at it and I say, well, what does this story mean? You know, what is its historical value? What does it say about the time and the place when it happened?
Hmm.
Now, it's just not enough time has elapsed to do that with a contemporary story. You know, I can look at it and I can say, this was a hoax, but this hoax reveals such and such about the time and place.
Yeah.
And it tells us about American culture in the 19th century, what was important to them, what wasn't important to them, you know, what fascinated them. It can be very revealing, but it takes time to appreciate that. And I certainly don't have the insight to do that with something that just happened. At least I've never tried it. So hey, maybe I'm brilliant and I don't know it.
Oh, you are. I think you are.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You should have seen the things people wrote on the. I announced today that you were on the show. It's like, I'm already nervous about interviewing people for the first time, folks. You know, it's even having done this for years, I still, like, get nervous. But then I post the news that I got you on the show, and it's like, hell yeah, Robert Schenck is an in-depth researcher. Looking forward to hearing him in a long form. Robert's a great story show. Glad you're getting him on, finally. So it's like,
that's very nice.
Yeah, yeah. So people love you, man.
That's great. You know, one of the reasons that going to the conference was such an interesting thing for me because writing is a hermit life.
Oh yeah.
You know, you spend your time. I can sum up my day in a few sentences. I wake up, I answer my email, or I forget to answer my email. I then go to a diner, a restaurant, or a pizzeria. I sit there and write for 4 hours or 3 hours, depending on how, before I start to get the stink eye from the manager.
Yeah.
And then I come home and I write all night. Or I try to write and I end up dicking around online or...
Yeah, some asshole convinces you to come on his podcast.
Oh, you see, that's a real-time bandit.
Now, you said before, you don't like stories that you've heard, that you've told a million, or you heard a million times, and
right.
I feel like you had to have told this bye-bye story, like, a million times as well, and considering the people who have wanted you to be on the show for so long, I'm sure they've heard you elsewhere, so they, if I have you tell the story, then they're going to be like, well, then, you know, I heard him on, like, 8 shows telling the story, but you wait all the time to have him on, and you have him tell the same story, so I don't...
And they'll say it just like that, too.
Exactly. And you wonder why this is the final season. So,
if you want to talk about the movie or...
That's what I want to ask you about, actually.
Sure.
So, because you seem like a real straight shooter, which I appreciate because I try to come from that school as well.
Oh,
so I guess, what was it like... let's go a little bit through the process of sort of like how you ended up... How this movie ended up coming from your story. Like how,
okay.
You mentioned it at the end of the book, And feel free to talk also sort of about how you feel without telling the story, without digging too much. You know, you feel free to do a thumbnail, but you know what I'm talking about. It's like,
sure. Okay.
About
all,
putting it out there into the world, because you
okay.
expressed reservations about that. But, like, the process
yeah.
and then sort of the overall impact you think it might have, you know, had.
Well, it started off with, a friend who told this story every year at his pre-Halloween party.
Mm-hmm.
The party would always end. He would ask people to tell a real life story, something that happened to them, and then when they were finished telling their stories, and they were usually some ghost stories or something along those lines, something that they saw when they were a kid or. You know, their grandmother showed up 3 years after she died to say hello. And then he would tell the story of the bye-bye man. And the first time I heard it, it got under my skin. It is the only story I have ever heard that got under my skin. And I have had people tell me stories about demons, ghosts, monsters, aliens. You know what it's like. You just the strangest things get poured into your ear when you do
right.
this sort of thing.
Right, right.
But this was the only one that actually spooked me. Just thinking about it gives me a little chill up my back right now. I'm not exaggerating.
Right.
And so I'll never forget the next morning I woke up and I was lying in bed and I was looking at that line of light under my door, which plays a big part in the story of the bye-bye man, seeing a shadow under that door. And I remember thinking to myself, I am still spooked.
Mm.
So I actually, the first version of it appeared in one of those adult magazines I mentioned. And then I wrote my first book, The President's Vampire, and I was very conflicted about whether to include the story of the bye-bye man. It wasn't historical, it wasn't this, it wasn't that, but it was such a good story that I had to put it in. And as it turned out, of course, that was the story that everyone was fascinated by, and I understand why they were.
Yeah.
So I set out to do something. I'm not a good planner, but this was one good plan I came up with. I said, I am going to do every tiny little radio show I can find, and I want to get good at doing radio shows, so by the time a Coast to Coast will have me on, I want to be good at telling this story.
Nice.
So.
Yeah.
So I started out, I'll never forget, the very first radio show I did for the President's Vampire was a show that was run by a lady in the Midwest who claimed to be the world's leading interdimensional photographer.
Oh, what an honor.
Yeah. And so from there, I went on to do dozens and dozens of shows. This was right when podcasting had become popular.
Jesus, I feel like an asshole.
Why?
Because this is the first time you've been on the show, dude.
No reason to. You know, you got to remember something, Tim. I go into these long periods where I completely withdraw, especially when I'm writing. I know that's all I'm doing.
Right, right. It was just hanging there in the air.
Oh. Well, again.
I was on thousands and thousands of shows. I'm like, oh, shit. It's kind of like I'm pulling at my collar like, hey.
No, really. This was when podcasting had just started.
Oh, yeah.
Really,
it was a million
everyone,
shows, yeah.
Everyone with a phone was doing a podcast. And
now I'm the only asshole on still using the
actually,
phone.
I thought that was kind of cool that you were the only one still doing it. you and Dan Zupansky, who does True Murder.
Yeah.
Those are two of my that is one of my favorite radio shows or podcast shows. So, you know, again, it's kind of neat that you're still doing it that way because, you know, everyone else gets caught up in the technology of it.
Yeah, to me, it's like, I always say it's like Dylan's music, man. You just got to listen to the words. Don't, you
right.
know, if you hear the, it's like, don't even worry about that, dude. Listen after a while and you'll get used to it and you'll know exactly what he's saying.
Right, right. But anyway, so I was doing all these podcasts and I was getting better at it. I had a joke that I told at a certain one point. And I even did something that I think was so marvelously clever, where I wouldn't say the name of the character because of the story. You know, that if you learn his name, he will come after you. And so that went on for a while. And finally, I was very surprised at this, Coast to Coast called me. So I don't think I have ever been as nervous as before I did Coast to Coast.
Yeah.
I was terrified. You could have wrung out my clothing. Really, I was.
It is the big time.
Yeah, this was the big time. I don't know how many. They still had millions of listeners. This was still kind of like the hangover from the Art Bell period.
Yeah, they still do have millions of listeners, I can tell you.
Oh, okay.
You that for sure.
I really don't know. I just know that it was still when it was still a phenomenon.
Mm.
And so I did it, and I told the story, and I think I spent the next day in bed with an ice pack on my head. And the next day I received an email from a kind of a well-known maker of generally sleazy films, but his stuff was, he was very good documentarian, strangely enough. His name was David Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
And David Pryor, he made a movie back in the 80s called Killer Workout, which was about a slasher in an aerobic salon, things like that.
Now I want to see that immediately.
Oh, yeah, David Pryor, he made some fun stuff. He really did. But it's just plain entertainment. But this is just kind of off subject. I found some documentaries he made about the Zodiac Killer that are terrific.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I mean, these are really good. And all he did was he got the people who were involved, the cops, the detectives, the people, you know, the victims that survived. He just sat them down in front of a white wall and let them talk.
Nice, yeah.
It is one of the most fascinating documentaries I've ever seen. He has since died. David Pryor died in a car accident. But anyway, he contacted me, and this was 12 years ago, maybe? More? I don't know. And he said he was interested in making a film out of it, and I said, yeah, sure, fine. Because I knew the odds then against the film actually being made were astronomical, and I also knew that the number of properties that are bought versus the number that actually end up on the screen, there's, you know, it's for every 10,000 bought, one might make it.
Yeah, God bless them. Somebody auctioned the rights to one of Nick Redfern's books, and it's still floating around out there in Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, and there are some people that actually make a living selling stories to be optioned that have never been made into a movie. But anyway, so I put it out of my mind. My publisher at the time, Patrick Weege, he took care of everything, and I tried not to think about it anymore. Then the Slender Man came along, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, look at that. It's doing what I hoped the Bye Bye Man would do. It's becoming a part of American folklore.
Yeah.
And so that came along, and the movie was still, you know, it was just in limbo for years and years. And then I got an email from somebody saying, you know, you're in Variety magazine. And I said, why am I in Variety magazine? And it said that they were starting to, they had got the funding for the movie. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, fine, that's great. You know, again, there's 10 million reasons why this will fall through. And then they were casting the movie. And then they were scouting locations for the movie. And then they shot it. And then I refused to believe it until it was actually released.
So you weren't like, they never really brought you into the process at all?
Oh, no, not at all. And that was fine. I didn't expect them to. They, you know, they bought the property, and...
Yeah, it's just weird. You'd think, like, the director would... You think someone would be like, well, bring me the guy who wrote the story so we can at least get an idea of, you know, da-da-da-da-da. They never even talked to you?
You'd think that. No, but they do it the way they want to, and that's fine.
Yeah, no. I'm just, it's an enlightening. It's enlightening, like,
well, maybe they
weird.
Do that. They probably do it with someone like Stephen King, but I am not Stephen King.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, but there's a human, I don't know, they just don't have the innate human curiosity that I do, that I, you know, because I would be like, get the guy who wrote, you know,
I know what you're saying, but you've got to remember, this is something that's been very difficult for me to learn, that Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff probably didn't care about horror movies. They were actors. They cared about acting.
Yeah.
And the people who write movies don't care about horror or the paranormal. They are interested in being entertaining. That's what fascinates them. And that's difficult for me to understand, because it's such a fascinating story, but you know, they're looking at it as, how can we get the audience excited and interested? And that's a very different, they have a very different starting place than people that are fascinated by the paranormal do. And it was very hard for me to wrap my mind around that, but I finally did. And
did you get to go, now in the book now you mentioned that you had visions of going to the premiere. Did you get to go to the premiere?
No.
Oh, what?
Do you want to hear a sad story?
Oh, my God. People are turning in. They're like, I thought I were going to hear creepy. No, I want to hear a sad story. Yeah.
This was the weekend that it premiered. I was disappointed that there was no premiere. I really was. So... it was playing at the mall near my house.
Yeah.
And I walked to the mall in the rain to watch my movie.
Oh, my God.
It was a January day, and there was a layer of slush on the ground.
Oh.
And I'm slogging through the slush to the mall to watch my movie.
Oh, my God.
But
that's crazy.
It was sad.
It's a great story, though. No offense. No, you know, I empathize completely, but at the same time, it's like, wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Do they at least say, like, in the credits at the beginning, are they, like, based on a story by Robert Snow?
The credits is one thing I have absolutely no complaints about at all. First of all, I get to the theater. It is all 12-year-olds. That's fine. They're having a good time. They're rowdy. And I'm there with a friend, and I met a friend at the mall, which was nice. I didn't want to have to go by myself. And so we're sitting there. We watch the movie, and then the credits run, and it was directed by Pow, Stacy Title. Screenplay by Pow, Jonathan Penner. Based on a story by Robert Schneck. Pow. So I was third in the credits, and
nice.
I got the whole screen to myself, and I have absolutely no complaints about that whatsoever.
Nice. All right. Well, it's very weird. Yeah, it's kind of like... And so did you... I mean, to flesh a whole movie out of a story like that is kind of... What did you think about the movie itself, sort of like...
Well, I had a good time.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand a lot of the choices they made. For example, there was a mythos that went with the Bye Bye Man. And I don't know why they made the changes they made. Because the story as written seemed very spooky and sufficient.
Yeah.
For a horror movie. And like I said, I just they changed elements, they added elements, and I just didn't understand why they made some of the changes they did, and why they were vague about things that would have explained a lot of what was going on. I mean, for me, I understood what was happening, but the audience, I don't know that the audience did. I got the feeling a lot of it was being set up for to become a franchise.
I was just going to ask you that. Is it possible, yeah, that they held some details back because they're going to, spin it off? How did the movie do? Is it possible that will happen?
I don't understand how movies work, but
right.
The movie was a very inexpensive movie from, a Hollywood perspective. I think the budget was $8 million or something.
Oh, wow. And did it make a lot, though?
Which was, for a movie that's got Faye Dunaway in it, that's kind of a surprise. But the movie made back its cost plus, I think it's something like $28 million or something. So it did okay.
Yeah.
And again, I have for a month I kept going to Variety to see what the box office was. That was an interesting experience, to see how's the film doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I honestly don't know if it's had much of an effect on book sales. I hope it has. You're supposed to check that online. I don't know where to look, though, and I've never really been very good at that stuff.
Yeah.
But I assume we sold some books. And, from beginning to end, it was an exciting experience. So, I'm very happy that it happened. And I don't expect that to ever happen again.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty crazy I don't know anyone. Like I said, Nick's story has been bouncing around kind of for years out there, so it's like I can't, and I'm sure, Travis Walton, but I can't think of too many people who've been on the show that had their stuff turned into a movie, so it's pretty cool.
It was an interesting experience. A friend of mine and I have, actually the friend who's been telling the story all these years, we were thinking about maybe going back to Wisconsin and shooting a little video on the true story and just putting it up on YouTube.
Yeah.
Just so, people can say, oh, this is the actual place where it happened, and this is what actually happened, and, nothing's fancy, just maybe get some, just so people can see the real thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But we just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Now, this is like an incredibly crass question in a sense, but I apologize. But at the same time, it's also, you can refute any skeptics and turds out there in the audience. Did you get rich from this?
No.
Are you like super wealthy now? Like, do you never have to work another day in your life because they made Bye Bye Man into a movie?
Oh, no. No, that's not a crass question. I mean, everyone wonders that stuff. You got to remember, it was a low-budget movie.
That's true, yeah.
So even though it got wall-to-wall commercials when it came out and stuff like that, the commercial budget has nothing to do with the film budget, and that's what my payment was based on. No, really, it was not very much, and it was kind of trickled out over time, so I never got a lump.
I see, yeah, yeah.
It was a nice little bonus every year for a couple of years.
All right. Yeah, like I said, because there's always – have you had to – I've seen some skeptical people try to, like, pull apart the story, but it's like it's just kind of an urban legend, folks. There's nothing really you can – there's nothing you can really – I think you'll agree, right? I mean, it's just a story you heard. It's like there's you're not like –
there were things to check. For example,
right.
the Bye Bye Man claimed the story that came through the Ouija board. He claimed that he grew up in an orphanage in Algiers, New Orleans, things like that. You could check.
Right.
And that was about it. But I have to say something for the skeptics, and that is that they really appreciated the fact that I checked those things.
That's
and
good.
All the ones that wrote about me, and that includes Ben Radford and a couple of other people,
mm-hmm.
they all appreciated the fact that I did the research, and they gave me credit for that. So I have nothing, I haven't had any problems with any skeptics.
Okay, that's good. All right.
Yeah.
Because I think
they might not agree with some of my other stories, where I come from on a bunch of things, but they all appreciated the fact that I did look into it.
Because, that's all you can ask.
Yeah, I mean, that's all you can ask. It's a story from a Ouija board. What do you want?
Yes, exactly. Well, that's good. Okay, because I think I try not to read those types of talk about sordid publications. I try not to read skeptics' blogs. They're to me, they are the ultimate sordid publication. So I think I'd passed over a title, mentioning your stuff, the Bye Bye Man, and I was like, oh, really? This is like Neil deGrasse Tyson dissecting Planet of the Apes. Like, we know it's a story, dude. Like, I don't need you to break down, like.
Well, I think part of the reason why they're comfortable with me is I'm not running around out there saying it's real. Run.
Right, exactly, yeah.
To me it was really interesting as an example of how folklore can be made.
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah.
It is regularly referred to now as an urban legend. It was never an urban legend. It was a story that came out of, something that
one neighborhood, though, like one circle, in a sense, I guess, and, it's a weird kind of, if it is an urban legend, it came from, we know where it traces back to. You heard it from the guy who, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know the address where it happened,
Right.
That's how close we are to the possible origin of an urban legend. All I ever really wanted from the Bye Bye Man was I thought it could become something like the Slender Man, and of course it predates the Slender Man.
Mm.
So that was always what I thought might happen to it. Now it's kind of, I'm not sure what's going to happen. Of course, now, millions of people have heard the name. There have been memes about it. There have been some funny memes about it. So all these people calling it an urban legend, maybe it'll become one. I don't know.
Well, here's sort of an interesting question. Have you talked to the dude who originally told you the story since it became like a part of the zeitgeist?
Yeah, sure.
What does he think of that development?
Nothing much. He just didn't like the movie. The only thing he liked about it was the T-shirts that the guy playing him wore. He wore a Sonic Youth T-shirt and he liked that.
He's real. If you say his name, or even think it, he'll come for you.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
I'm afraid of putting this into your head.
Tell me.
Bye bye, man.